From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is just settling into her vacation with another week to go. Meanwhile, I'm here from San Francisco enjoying the humidity. On this edition of Fresh Air, director Alan Pakula tells us what it's like to make a movie when millions of people already know the story. Pakula's credits include All the President's Men, Sophie's Choice, and the new film based on the bestseller Presumed Innocent. Also today, writer Tony Hiss joins us for an investigation into what makes some places pleasant, others uncomfortable, even scary. World music critic Milo Miles serves up some conjunto music, and poet Mark Halliday reads two of his works. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. The Pentagon says two U.S. Navy warships intercepted two Iraqi vessels in the Persian Gulf today. After determining that the ships were empty, the U.S. vessels allowed them to proceed. A Pentagon statement says the interdiction occurred early this afternoon Eastern Time as the Iraqi ships headed toward Iraq. The Pentagon will not say how the warships determined that the vessels were empty, but it did say the Iraqi ships were not boarded. About 50,000 Islamic fundamentalists in Algeria have demonstrated against the United States and for Iraq. Their leaders called on Muslims worldwide to overthrow their governments as a first step toward getting Western troops out of the Gulf. From neighboring Tunis, Peter Hyatt reports.
Fundamentalists poured out of the mosques after Friday prayers, waving banners with slogans such as "No to the American presence in the holy places." They converged on one of Algiers' main squares to hear their leader, Dr. Abassi Madani, describe the American force as shameful. And urging a boycott of Western goods, he ordered, "Don't eat American bread." Demonstrators cheered and shouted, "God is great," as he said the first step towards getting the Americans out of the Gulf was for ordering Muslims to rise up and topple the governments which have sanctioned the colonial borders dividing the Arab world. "There must be no more frontiers between Muslim peoples," he said. The fundamentalists are the biggest opposition party in the country and stand a good chance of forming the next Algerian government. The current Algerian authorities began by denouncing Iraq's invasion of Kuwait, but, like the rest of the country, quickly switched their criticism to the presence of Western forces in the Gulf. For National Public Radio, this is Peter Hyatt in Tunis.
Iraq began withdrawing troops from the Iranian border today, part of a package of peace concessions offered to free Iraqi troops from its eastern border. More than 30 divisions, about 300,000 soldiers, are now moving to confront the massive military buildup in the Gulf. NPR's Deborah Amos reports.
Iran reported the first movement on the border last night as the Iraqis moved armor and equipment. By 5 a.m. this morning, Iraqi ground troops were on the move. The Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein made his offer of dramatic concessions to the Iranians on Tuesday. By today, he'd made good on the offer when 1,000 Iranian prisoners of war crossed the border. The Iranians let 1,000 Iraqis go home, all under the supervision of the International Committee of the Red Cross. Iranians have made it clear that peace in the Iran-Iraq war is a separate issue. In a speech at Friday prayers in Tehran, the prayer leader advised Saddam Hussein to withdraw from Kuwait before the world jumps on him. "Then we can tell the Americans to go home," he said. In Dubai, this is Deborah Amos.
Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev saying the Cold War is over today pledged to make major military changes in his country next year. Those changes could include switching to an all-volunteer force and eliminating some armed services altogether. On Wall Street, stock prices were lower. The Dow Jones fell 37 points to 2644.80. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Sedge Thompson. When someone in publishing asked just how big a book, Presumed Innocent, the murder mystery by Scott Turow, would be, the insider responded, referring to the publicity campaign, "Big, very big. We're talking bus cards, those posters on the sides of buses. And about 4 million copies of the book have been sold. And hot books are hot Hollywood properties." And the film made from the book is now out, directed by my guest today, Alan Pakula. Adapting well-known books for the screen is familiar work for Pakula. He produced To Kill a Mockingbird and Up the Down Staircase. The first movie he directed was The Sterile Cuckoo, and subsequently directed from an original screenplay, the thriller Clute. He won an Academy Award nomination for his direction of All the President's Men, and another for his adaptation of William Styron's Sophie's Choice, that he also directed. He just directed Presumed Innocent. Harrison Ford portrays Rusty Sabich, a prosecuting attorney accused of murdering his former mistress and colleague. Bonnie Bedelia portrays his wife, and Raul Julia, his defense attorney. It's part investigation, part courtroom drama. It's a suspense story many have read, and a story some are waiting to read before they then see the movie. I ask Alan Pakula, was it the script treatment or the book that attracted him to Presumed Innocent?
Both, actually. I read the book and was interested in doing a film, and the first draft screenplay was sent to me by Sidney Pollack and Mark Rosenberg, who were the producers. And I read the first draft screenplay, and I saw how difficult it was to adapt this into a film. It's a story told in the first person, and there's nothing quite comparable, literally comparable, in film, as there is to telling first person in a book. So we really spent, from the time I said I would do it, we spent about a year on the script, Frank Pearson and I, and it just needed all that time. If you're doing a suspense film, it is very important the audience have certain facts, so they always know where they're at, so they know what to hope for or what to be afraid of. That's where the excitement comes from. That's where the suspense comes from. If the audience has no set of facts that they can relate to, then there's no suspense. And you have to have this feeling of, oh, this could happen or this can happen. Which one will happen? That's suspense. If you don't have enough set of facts to say, to have that, to ask those questions, then you just sort of go along staring at the story, but there is not that kind of excitement. And with a story this complicated, with this many characters, this kind of character study, whodunit, you're always juggling these characters, making sure that the audience doesn't have too many names that they have to follow, too many clues they have to follow at once. Harrison Ford and I kept asking questions of each other every second. We would test each other by saying, all right, what do you know now about the story? Tell me, as the audience, where are you? What information do you have and what don't you have? We would keep checking.
There's a need in the course of one of these stories to place clues, facts or clues, as you go along. And how did you decide to weight certain clues versus others? Did you want the audience to try to figure out the story?
I wanted the audience to feel they were always on the verge of figuring out the story, that they were about to do it and then be teased along that much farther and given another clue that might throw them off the track. There have been several films this summer that have been physical roller coaster rides. This one is really a mental roller coaster ride, in a sense, in that you are taken in one direction and then suddenly another clue takes you in another direction. And that's the fascination of this kind of thing. At the same time, unlike the ordinary melodrama story, or in the average melodrama story, Scott Turow wrote very complicated, rich characters. And you then have to stop to really develop those characters at the same time. Hitchcock once said, one of the most difficult things to do is to do character studies and suspense at the same time because the rhythms are different. So you're always balancing those rhythms. How long can you stop for character? You really can never let that story go. The great gift that Scott gave us was this extraordinary plot. At the same time, that plot became our master. We always had to serve it. In an ordinary film, you can, you know, be more leisurely and start exploring character for its own sake. Here, character always had to be revealed within the context of the plot being revealed.
You were quite loyal to many details in the book, not only the course of action, but the even the kinds of clothes that people wore, the color of the hair.
Well,
of the characters.
The difficulty of doing an adaptation of a best-selling book is that you have about, well, in this case, with about 4 million copies of the book was sold, you have millions and millions of other picture makers, because everybody who reads a book is a picture maker. He has pictures of what those characters look like, what those locales look like, and now you come in with the arrogance of the filmmaker and say, yeah, but this is what it really looked like. And it better in some ways correspond to what the author's intent was if you're going to capture the audience in that way.
Your lead, Harrison Ford, who played Rusty Savage, is a guy I associate with a fedora, a whip, or a ray gun. And here he played a very closed-in, repressed character. What did you have to do with him to get him to play this much more sort of quiet, passive, reactive, rather than active role?
Actually, he's not a passive character. Indeed, events seem to take him over in many ways, but I wouldn't say that he's passive. He's a passionate prosecuting attorney when the story opens. He's a man of deep emotions. As a matter of fact, what I find interesting about the character is that it is a very active man who finds himself in a very passive position. The prosecutor is very active, and suddenly he finds himself on trial for murder, where you really are in a passive position. At the same time, he does, even during that period, have efforts in trying to deal with the case. It's a very difficult thing to ask an actor to do, especially a man who's played Indiana Jones. And the time when you work on that is even before he's decided to do it. I went out to Harrison's ranch in Wyoming when we had a script, and we spent several days together. We read through the script because while Harrison was interested, he was concerned about playing this role for the very reasons you pointed out. And I read all the other characters, and he read Rusty Savage's character. I read all the other characters badly, I might add, and I was surprised that he could even sound all real, considering he was playing these scenes over a kitchen table with me. But during that time, we would stop and start, and you would find and discuss all of the active things going on in this character, even though he may not be revealing them obviously, in dialogue. And during that time, we really found the arc of the character, the growth of the character, all of the things that might not be revealed in an immediate reading of the script, where so many of the other characters have so much more bravura dialogue, for example, than his character has. It was once, I think, Harrison saw how rich the character was in an interior way that he could, one, commit himself to do the film, and then allow himself to give such a controlled performance. The difficulty in playing that kind of character is you can't cheat. If you're playing a man who has deep feeling but has a difficult time revealing it, he better darn well be feeling that deep feeling so that that audience has some sense that something is going on underneath. Otherwise, it'll be totally empty.
There's been a lot of comment about Harrison Ford's haircut in the production, and I'm wondering if this is one aspect that you tried to set up to set him apart from his previous sort of hero roles.
You brought up something which is a perfect example of how nobody knows who does what on a film.
Uh-huh.
Some critics, it amuses me, will say, well, the director did this, and this actor did this, and the writer did this, and the cameraman did this. And very often at the end of a film, nobody remembers what they did. when it works, it's a synthesis. But in the case of Harrison's haircut, I do know, because it became a kind of mini conflict. Harrison called me on the phone from Wyoming one day, all excited, and said, "I've got my haircut." And I said, "What?" He said, "I'm going to have a very short haircut." And there was a very long pause on the other end of the phone from me. And I said, "Well, why?" And he said, "Well, I am playing this Midwestern man, and you say you would like him to be an ordinary man, and you don't want him to look like a movie star, and you'd like him to be like the man down the block." And I said, "Harrison, all of that is true. At the same time, we hired Harrison Ford, who was a film star, and I would be deeply concerned if you come out of this as a fairly unrecognizable character actor. There can be truth in that performance, but at the same time we can recognize who the actor is who's playing the role." He said, no, you're going to love it. And I said, "I'm not sure of this." He said, "Look, I'll come to New York and you look at the haircut." He came to New York and I looked at the haircut. Never has there been so much discussion over how the length of somebody's hair in a film. Certainly not a man's. And he came in the office and I was disturbed because he looked so different. By the time he left the office, I realized not only was it right for the film, but it's one of those things that was a great help to him. He was no longer Indiana Jones. He was no longer Harrison Ford to himself. He was nobody but the character of Rusty Savage.
My guest is film director Alan Pakula. He directed Presumed Innocent, the new film based on Scott Turow's novel, which stars Harrison Ford. When you were making All the President's Men, you reconstructed a Washington Post newsroom down to having Washington Post memos in the trash can, details like that. Did you end up reconstructing sets of courtrooms and prosecuting attorneys' offices for presumed innocent as well?
Yes, well, I had the same production designer, George Jenkins, who was an absolute stickler for reality. And we were looking for places in the Midwest to shoot the film, and we found a courtroom in Cleveland. It's a federal courtroom, and we both became very enthusiastic about it. And it had the dignity and the majesty of the whole concept of law. And part of the tension of this story, of this film, is the contrast between the ideal of justice and the flawed manner in which justice is executed. We toyed with the idea, actually, of shooting in that courtroom, and it became impractical. And indeed, it became the basis. It is not exactly that courtroom, but I would say that there's a 75% to 80% similarity. We even got a copy of the mural that hung in the courtroom to use in our film.
You shot much of the, or some of the movie in Detroit, which is a very tough city with a tiny core and lots of blank and burnt-out neighborhoods. Did you have to work around those geographical restrictions in Detroit?
No, quite the opposite. I really wanted all the contrast one could get for the city. The story in the book takes place in, mid-sized Midwestern city. I remember when I went to talk to Scott Turow the first time, the writer of the book, and I said, tell me, Scott, a lot of people think this took place in Chicago, although it seemed to me you indicated a smaller city than that. And he said, well, yes, it was smaller. And I said, well, for example, when I asked him where one courtroom was, he said, oh, that was in Boston where I worked. And I said, and I asked him another courtroom. He said, oh, that was in Chicago where I was also worked in the prosecutor's office. And I said, and what about the ferry that takes him from his house to the city in which he works? He said, oh, that's Oakland, San Francisco, where I taught at one time. And I said, thanks a lot, Scott. I mean, you have a total composite and pastiche. So we had to recreate this composite city. I was fascinated by Detroit because it has all the high contrasts of a modern American city today. But, for example, the magic of movies is that this man starts out, when I say this is a composite, he starts out from a house that we shot in Allendale, New Jersey. His wife drives him in a car and drops a child off at school, at a school in Allendale, New Jersey. She then drives him down to the ferry, which is in Windsor, Canada, across the river from river from Detroit. He then gets on a boat that takes him to Detroit. He then climbs up the steps of an exterior of a building where he works, and that building is in New York. He walks into the interior lobby, and that is at City Hall of Newark, New Jersey. Then he goes upstairs, and he walks into his offices, and that's a set in Astoria, Long Island. And out of all of those different places, halfway around the country, comes one place. That is the magic of movies.
Did you ever get confused in the shot sequence?
Well, no, you plan that out. The amazing thing is that even though you've been through it and you've shot all this, when you run the film for yourself, when you're cutting it, you just never think about the fact that it took place in all those places. It just seems as natural to you as it does to an ordinary audience. It's all in one place. That's the extraordinary hypnotic quality that brings everything together in film.
My guest is film director Alan Pakula. His films include All the President's Men, Clute, and Sophie's Choice. He directed the new film, Presumed Innocent. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Alan Pakula. You've produced and directed many great films over the years, many of them from books, including To Kill a Mockingbird, Up the Down Staircase, Sophie's Choice, All the President's Men, Presumed Innocent. What is it about books that attracts you as a director, say, to screenplays?
Well, it's, by the way, I mean, I also do things like Clute that are from original
screenplays. Right, right,
well. I just want you to think that I'm a purist about only doing books. However, there is a great attraction in books, and that is all the extraordinary texture, the world you have to draw upon in a really good novel. There is so much background texture, subtext you might call it, it'll be subtext in a film anyway, that gives that sense of reality and richness that you have to draw upon that is sometimes more difficult to get in an original screenplay. I sometimes think that too often the average screenwriter will spend too short a time doing a screenplay, maybe weeks or months. This is not always the case, but in many cases. And a good novelist is very often spent years in developing that world and developing those characters. And that time very often has paid off in giving you just a much richer world to work with. I'm not saying, by the way, that you can't, that a genius or somebody like Preston Sturges can't write a great movie in a week or two, because there are cases of that. But by and large, having that kind of background world that the novel gives you to inform a film can be very helpful indeed. Now, that has other problems. I mean, you're taking something that was designed to function in one way and asking it to function in another way. And there are many novels, I would say, that by their very nature are almost impossible to do as films.
How did you first learn to read a screenplay?
How did I learn to read a screenplay? Nobody's asked me that. I learned to read a screenplay when I had my first job at MGM. I was in love with the theater. I was a theater director when I got out of Yale. And I was 20 and at that age thought I knew a good deal more than I did, as it turned out. And it never occurred to me I had to learn how to read a screenplay. I got my first job at MGM and I was reading screenplays and making a lot of, I think, unfair, arrogant judgments. And I think in making those judgments, found out a good deal about what worked and what didn't work. I remember being at Paramount, and I was about 21, 22, and reading the screenplay of Rear Window and thinking, well, it's all very pleasant, but I don't really get the suspense in this. You know, I'm strange that Hitchcock is doing this film when it doesn't seem to have very much suspense. Well,
that must have startled you when you saw the film.
Well, when I began seeing dailies, I began learning a great deal of humility, because the difference between what is on the written page and what a director may have in mind, can be extraordinary. And while it was a perfectly craftsmanlike screenplay, the vision that Hitchcock had that informed that film was extraordinary. And I sometimes think that even today that people who make the decisions about what films should be made and should not be made don't know how to read a screenplay. Very often will skim over because they read so many scripts, they'll take home 10 or 15 scripts to read over a weekend because they have all these decisions to make. And I think when you read that way, there's a tendency to kind of read through the dialogue. You know, and that can be a very bad way to read a screenplay, because that's not how the film's going to look. I also think that people, this is my advice to executives today, I think, should really not judge a screenplay until, if there was a director involved, or make a final judgment, until they've discussed the screenplay with the director and seen see exactly what he has in mind and how much that vision is reflected by the screenplay. But those two things should go together in making the final decision.
There's a scene in Clute, which was from an original screenplay, where Jane Fonda sings a hymn, and I understand this was actually not part of the screenplay. I wonder how her, a call girl in the movie, began to sing this hymn and how it became included in the movie.
Well, that's a wonderful thing about working with actors. I always say to actors, however much we rehearse, and I believe in rehearsing, nothing pleases me more than surprises. What happens in the moment, what comes out of your own behavior. In Clute, again, we had the problem of a melodrama that was really a character study and the two rhythms. I mean, how much time could you take to explore character? So we didn't, while she was this complicated call girl, we didn't reveal a great deal about her background. And we looked for ways to do that. And here she was just called, it was a scene at the very early part of the picture, and she's just picked up a trick and just had the trick, and now she's home in her apartment alone, and she's smoking pot at that point and sitting there and relaxing. And at that moment, I was also trying to dramatize it. In some ways, that trick for her was a fix, not a sexual fix. Somewhere or other, it was a release of some kind of compulsive tensions. And for that moment, there was a moment of peace. And she's sitting in her apartment alone, smoking that pot. And I didn't say to Jane, do a hymn. I just said, you know that character well enough. We've rehearsed this thing long enough. Let's see what you feel like. And she sat there, and she started to hum in this pot-like trance that this character's in. And there was this hymn that most of us have all learned at Thanksgiving as children in school. And suddenly you could see this character in some small town somewhere, having been an ordinary little child or with some kind of upbringing we could all relate to. That just came out of Jane. Just as Jane insisted on having health food in the refrigerator in that apartment. And it, again, created a fascinating tension of a girl who has this most self-destructive kind of behavior, being a prostitute, and then goes home and stocks her refrigerator full of health food and makes herself all sorts of health food mixes. That's the kind of work I ask from actors. We sometimes try to create together, and I also encourage them to do it for themselves.
Your director of photography for Presumed Innocent, Gordon Willis, also worked with you on All the President's Men and on Clute. Each has its own distinctive visual style.
Well, he worked with me on Clute, on Parallax View. Yes, All the President's Men, and the last picture we'd done before Presumed Innocent was a Western with Jane Fonda called Comes a Horseman. All very different, and of course he's done the Godfather films, just done Godfather 3, which is again another very different style, and did so many films of Woody Allen, as a matter of fact. I think the visual style of Woody Allen began when Gordon Willis started working with him. Gordon worked with me on Clute. It was the second picture I'd ever done as a director, and I was still unsure of my visual ideas. I had strong feelings, and I wasn't sure how much I should trust them. And Gordon was the one who said, trust them. He's a remarkable, remarkable craftsman. He's a great artist. And he does not just make pretty pictures. He thinks conceptually. One of the wonderful things with Gordon is when you have your first meeting with him, and you say, this is my visual concept of this film. And 6 months later, when you're two-thirds of the way through production and everybody's tired and most people are fighting the flu, which invariably happens on films, he will remind you when you're trying to compromise, that was not your visual conception of the film, Al. So he's not only just a wonderful tool for a director, he's also a superb collaborator.
Well, Alan Pakula, I want to thank you very much for coming and being a guest with us on Fresh Air today.
Thank you very much.
My guest today, film director Alan Pakula. His new film is Presumed Innocent. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson with Fresh Air. For each of us, there are places that make us feel relaxed, at peace, perhaps without really knowing why. Writer Tony Hiss examines these feelings in himself and in the rest of us. Coming up, Tony Hiss talks with us about the experience of place. Also, world music critic Milo Miles introduces us to the conjunto music of Steve Jordan. And our poet in residence, Mark Halliday, stops by his home away from home, the spacious, soundproof room, to read for us today. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. All day long in Baghdad, American diplomats have been trying to reach 35 Americans who had been held in the Rashid Hotel, but are no longer there. The Iraqi government has not said where they were taken, and the State Department has expressed its concern. Barry Schweid reports.
U.S. Embassy officials figured the Americans had been moved to another hotel where British citizens are being detained. But the officials were not permitted to enter. They went to the Iraqi Foreign Ministry, and there they were told that Iraq would do its best to put them in touch. But by nightfall, the 35 Americans were still missing, and the State Department said it was concerned. The word hostage isn't being applied to the situation yet, but for the first time since the crisis began 2 weeks ago, administration spokesmen aren't challenging reporters who use the word. Said one spokesman, "I can't speculate on that yet." In Kuwait, meanwhile, an Iraqi order that all 2,500 Americans go to a central hotel was largely ignored. Five Americans showed up, and they found no Iraqi official there to meet them. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
The Iraqi news agency is reporting that Iraq's parliamentary speaker says Baghdad would, in his words, play host to citizens of aggressive nations for as long as it is threatened with war. Seven people were arrested in West Germany today on suspicion of helping Iraq build a chemical weapons factory. Deidre Berger reports.
The broad government coalition in East Berlin between conservative and leftist center parties could fall apart this weekend. The second-largest party, the Social Democrats, say it is unacceptable that four ministers were dismissed without coalition approval. Yesterday, Prime Minister Lothar de Maizière fired the economics, finance, and agricultural ministers, charging incompetence. The justice minister resigned. The dispute highlights growing differences within the East German government coalition about the conditions for political unification and solutions to the country's enormous economic problems. West German Chancellor Helmut Kohl today said he assumes the two Germanys will be politically reunified by the latest in mid-October. Elections for an all-German parliament are scheduled for December 2nd. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
As part of Iraq's plan to make peace with Iran, about 1,000 Iranian prisoners of war have been sent home. Iraqi troops have also started pulling back from the Iranian border. As the first group of former prisoners arrived in Iran, a foreign ministry spokesman said an equal number of Iraqi prisoners would be sent home. The UN has estimated that both countries home more than 100,000 prisoners of war. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 36.5 points to close at 2,644.80, volume 213 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Later on the show, I'll talk with writer Tony Hiss about the science of our surroundings and also about his father, Alger Hiss. But first, sometimes world music performers are obscure, not because they live far away, but because they're hard to track down. They're not interested in selling millions of albums and getting on MTV. World music critic Milo Miles has a profile of one such proud independent accordion player, Steve Jordan. Milo says Jordan isn't a crossover artist, but he does like crossing musical boundaries.
That yipping wild man is Chicano bandleader Steve Jordan, often acclaimed as the fastest and most imaginative accordion player in the form known as conjunto, which literally means combo. There are several types of conjunto, but Jordan's is a kind of Mexican-American bar band music, featuring guitar, bass, and trap drums, as well as accordion. The 52-year-old Jordan is just so furiously eclectic that he keeps his conjunto sounding young, even avant-garde, by adding fresh rancheras, waltzes, and cumbias. Here he is absorbing country and western. And here he is tackling Caribbean salsa. But simple boldness won't prove Jordan's the true king of accordion squeezers. He belongs to the tradition of flashy, swaggering conjunto accordionists that began with Narciso Martinez in the 1930s and reached a sort of classical apex with Flaco Jimenez in the 1960s. What sets Jordan apart is not simply technical expertise, like his ability to play solos while singing, but his free-ranging rhythms, his unexpected chords, and his sweet and strange turns of sound that never fail.
Llegaron las coronelas.
Qué bien.
Háganlas pasar.
¿Qué pasa?
Que se haga el pobre. ¿Se haga?
Jordan is a free spirit among free spirits. He's met the various hardships of his life by keeping in motion and slipping out of snares. He was blinded in one eye soon after birth, which led to his nickname, El Parche, or The Patch. Jordan's parents were migrant farm workers in the Southwest, and he grew up in desperate poverty with 15 brothers and sisters. Such a situation leaves little time for school, and Jordan was a professional musician by the time he was 14 and eventually learned to play some 30-odd instruments. Of course, the standard subject of Jordan's cantina repertoire is ill treatment at the hands of the opposite sex, surrounded by a haze of heavy drinking. But he often breaks away from cliché, as with a lament about an oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, or this Springsteen-like number, The Ballad of Johnny the Pachuco. It's not that Jordan doesn't get around. He provided music for films like Born in East L.A. and Talking Heads' True Stories. He's recorded almost 40 albums, but none of them under contract. He's done 20 years of one-shot deals. His latest is a collection of late 70s and early 80s singles called El Huracan, and it is a strong blower. Still, Jordan likes the wide open spaces and is as likely to be fishing for shrimp as making the weekend gig. But if you're ever in South Texas and hear a dervish accordion in a dance hall down the street, it just might be El Parche, squeezing them dead again.
Milo Miles is a freelance journalist who writes about pop music for the New York Times and the Village Voice. Hey, let's hear some more El Parche, Steve Jordan. This is Fresh Air. Ever notice how a certain place can make you feel comfortable or ill at ease? Tony Hiss has and has written about these experiences as he wonders why we react the way we do to our cities, towns, and natural surroundings. For the past 27 years, Hiss has been a writer at The New Yorker. For the past decade, he's examined our relationship to our environment. Some of his longer pieces from The New Yorker are now part of a new book he calls The Experience of Place. Hiss grew up in Washington, D.C. and New York City. His father is Alger Hiss, the State Department official who was accused of treason at the height of the McCarthy era and spent several years in jail. Hiss says that our relationship to our surroundings needs to be discussed in the public arena because they affect us so deeply. His own awareness began as a kid in New York.
This was just after the Second World War, and because of the war and the Depression before that, New York hadn't changed very much for almost 20 years. And then suddenly the post-war boom hit, and it began to change very rapidly. And even though I was a pretty small kid, it was easy enough to see that not only the city was changing, but that as the city changed, the people were changing with it. So it's something that began to become of great interest to me. And I guess I've just been lucky enough to be able to keep my eye on it ever since, because when I got out of college, I came back to New York and went to work here, so...
Has your perception of a place like Grand Central Terminal changed from the time that you were a kid to that of an adult? Does it look different, feel different to you over these years?
Well, it doesn't even really feel much smaller because it's such a vast space that it's still huge no matter what size you are when you go through it. I think it's been quite a remarkably constant experience here in New York City, except for the fact that in the last few years, there's so many homeless people and unfortunates who've had to take refuge and shelter there, but that's changed the nature of the experience somewhat.
The nature of homeless people has also changed experience with public parks, places where people, once went for recreation, now avoid both homeless and as a threatening place. What happens, in your view, when public places lose this sort of feeling of welcome and become places of ominousness?
That's a very good question, because I think a lot of it has to do, with people's perceptions as much as it has to do with the actual changing reality. One of the reasons Grand Central seems changed by the presence of homeless people is that it was never designed to give much comfort or succor to homeless people. It's just a space to be moved through, basically. Whereas the parks can actually be designed in a way so that the homeless people and people in need feel in comfort there. And the more people who have jobs can also feel comfortable there. But the perception changes as people see people that they feel uncomfortable with in a place they're not used to seeing them. And the perception of the danger tends to increase far faster than any actual danger.
What are your criteria for finding a place that makes you feel good to be in, that you'll find yourself lingering in?
Well, there are many things that you tend to keep track of. Is it a place that seems to beckon you forward by being approachable in the first place? It's easy to enter. You don't have to climb huge steps to get into it. Is it a place that seems where one space seems to lead into the next, so that you're sort of drawn from one thing into another? Is it a place where you could stop and linger, perhaps in some kind of alcove or corner or next to a column where you can feel protected and yet have a chance to look out at what everyone else is doing and still remain in contact with what they're doing? It's easy enough to establish, I think, just by slowing down, keeping your eyes and ears open and seeing just how you do respond, because we're all of us doing it all the time. We often are preoccupied with whatever task we have to work on, but this seems to be going on at very much at the same time.
One of the difficulties, I think, with conveying a sense of an urban design is that non-planners, non-architects, can't really read or understand even an architectural model or a so-called architect's rendering of a site, that, you know, this confuses us, and that the reality of what is built is so much different from what it looks like on paper or there as an architectural model on a table. Is there any way that you have found in your research of the science of place that this experience can be sort of shared equally between the architect and a passenger through an architecturally designed space?
Out in your area, in the Bay Area, the technique of environmental simulation has been pioneered over the last 15, 20 years. What they do is they take simple physical models and they photograph them in a special lab using a camera that has for its lens something developed for periscopes and tanks in World War II. And this hovers over the street level of the model and crawls by at what would be walking speed if you were 2 inches tall. The films made through this camera, remarkably, seem to give you a chance to actually experience a place in advance.
You work as a staff writer for The New Yorker, and a number of your articles show up signed by you, but also you write for that anonymous chalkboard, the Talk of the Town.
That's right.
Does your writing style change? Do you feel a little looser when you write anonymously?
I don't know that I've ever asked myself that question. It seems to be very much the same kind of process, actually. You're trying to put yourself into the reader's situation. I've found it very good training for many years to write Talk of the Town stories, because you had to concentrate on the words, since no one was going to be able to recognize you from your signature.
With Rogers E.M. Whitaker, you wrote a book, All Aboard with E.M. Frimbo. E.M. Frimbo was a nom de train.
That's
for
right.
Rogers Whitaker. Would you ride along with him in these train rides?
Oh, yes, often. Although I was far behind him, because he logged something like 3 million miles on trains in his career. He was one of the founding editors and mentors at The New Yorker, sort of one of the last surviving remnants of the roundtable crowd from the Algonquin. Extraordinary man in many ways. He edited about a third of the magazine for many years, wrote their nightclub reviews, wrote an Ivy League football column decades after most newspapers had given up such a column.
What did he teach you about riding trains?
Oh, about riding trains? Mm-hmm. I think that was very much part of my education in how the way you experience a place affects what you think of yourself, or who you think you are, what you feel connected to, what you feel cut off from. Because trains take so much of the effort, when they're running properly, out of getting from one place to another. You're free to walk about, look out big windows, and drink in your surroundings. At the same time, you feel connected to the other people around you.
The biography you wrote of your father, Alger Hiss, Laughing Last, is extremely frank for a memoir of a father by a son. What was his reaction to your book?
It was a friendly reaction. I think that he got the point of what I was trying to do, which was, I kept having the feeling that so many people had so many fixed opinions about this case, based often on just sort of automatic responses, whether they were for him or against him. And that if they could set those aside for a few minutes and try to look at the people involved, they might come to a different kind of conclusion about who was involved and what happened and why it happened.
Did your experience going through the trials, knowing what your father went through, shape your sense of place in any way?
I think that it shaped my sense of place in terms of thinking that it was very important to, I was just a kid at the time, but it was very important to know exactly where you were, because since we don't know what's going to happen next, we need to be very much alive at the time when we're here. So in that sense, it helped me. I think my father helped me in many other ways. The strength and dignity with which he went through his totally unexpected experience, I think, has been of great help to me over the years. He's a remarkable man in many ways. He's someone who likes to say that 3 years in prison is a good corrective to 3 years at Harvard. I've really never known anyone come through something with such absence of bitterness and sweetness.
Would your father take you along to Grand Central Terminal and point out sights there? Did he introduce you to places as magical experiences?
Yes. I remember going with him to the old Pennsylvania Railroad Station in New York, as well as to Grand Central and up to Vermont when I was a little boy in the summertime. I think he always had a very strong sense that where you were had a lot to do with who you were, and at the same time that it was part of people's responsibilities as citizens to make sure that places provided the kind of warmth and nutrition that people need to function, both as individuals and as members of the larger society.
Tony Hiss, thank you very much for coming in and being a guest with us on Fresh Air today.
Thank you so much.
Tony Hiss is a staff writer for The New Yorker. His book, The Experience of Place, is published by Knopf. This is Fresh Air. Coming up later here on National Public Radio, today's edition of All Things Considered, another complex day. Linda Wertheimer, our host from All Things Considered, is here with us for a preview. Hello, Linda.
Hello, Sej. We're still talking, of course, about the Persian Gulf and about Americans who are still there in Iraq and Kuwait. Are they hostages? Exactly what is their standing? The United States has said that it will prevent goods getting into Iraq and coming out of Iraq. But is that a blockade? And if it is it legal? We'll also be looking at the American oil patch in West Texas and how those oil fields are affected by what is going on in the Middle East.
Thanks, Linda. That's later here on All Things Considered on National Public Radio. Mark Halliday is back to tell us some of his poems. He has two. The first is about how there is more to each life than we usually acknowledge.
Cleveland. Just as there is an Uncle Henry in Chicago who once met F. Scott Fitzgerald, and just as there is a Mary in Winchendon, Massachusetts, who drives boys crazy in the eighth grade by saying one thing and meaning another, and her hair is so long and sleek, and just as someone in St. Louis recalls an accidental death in 1935, you know also that in Cleveland there has to be a boy named Harold who has a cat named, perhaps, Scuffy, and their relationship is amusingly unsentimental if observed closely. And Harold's mother's name is Jane, and she is only 27, hanging wash on the line in her tiny backyard, the way she plucks up clothespins two at a time while humming along with an old Four Seasons hit. Jane was born in 1963, but she likes songs from when she was a little girl. She was a quick little girl in Ashtabula, and she remembers her dad yelling at the TV the day some man named Bobby was shot. And nowadays, she'll say in the company lunchroom, "I keep waiting for my kind of Democrat. I wonder where they all went." Harold's father sends money, but not much, and Jane is getting cynical about Dennis, a guy with his own small sporting goods store who may never make an offer. And if you got a close-up of her eyes, when she is watching Harold with Scuffy, or Dennis with Harold at an Indians game, you would think, this is more important than Jessica Lange or Meryl Streep, more important than Diane Keaton or Deborah Winger. You would start to care about Jane. All that poignancy in Cleveland? Who has enough time? Here's a poem called Cover Versions, which has to do with the feeling that your truest life is in a way a life you never quite get to. Cover Versions. At night, I take the inner life out of its sleeve, put on the headphones, and let it spin. I know the grooves where the needle is liable to hang. There's my mother sobbing, but that's my boy at Kennedy Airport. There's my father saying, you can't just sit under a tree and invite your soul. There's Kathy crying, I'm not the same. And Eric, at the bottom of the stairs, only saying, I thought we were friends. There is one song on side B the needle never seems to get to. I wake at night, and through many floors, I can almost hear the bass guitar giving that song a rock outline cut in the black dirt below me. If I ever hear it, I'll know that tune. Ethereal harmonies like the Everly Brothers at their best. Kathy sits beside me on the sofa. Eric deigns to keep time. Daddy thinks I've done well. All in that song. And my mother's sort of still alive. Meanwhile, I haven't quit shopping for cover versions that get a few things right.
Mark Halliday's collection of poems, Little Star, is published by William Morrow.
When I want you in my arms, when I want you, and all your charms, whenever I want you, all I have to do is dream.
Our interviews are produced by Phyllis Myers and Amy Sallet. Naomi Person produces the reviews and commentaries. It's all edited and mixed by Roberta Shorrock and Joan Tuohy and Allison Dufty. And today we say goodbye to Scott McLean, who's been helping us out here this summer. He just ran 6 blocks to get us this Everly Brothers record. He's returning to St. John's College in Annapolis, Maryland. Safe journey, Scott. For Terry Gross, I'm Sedge Thompson.
I can make you mine, taste your lips of wine.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, David Brown, who produced Jaws and The Sting and writes the cover blurbs for Cosmopolitan, the magazine his wife, Helen Gurley Brown, edits. Also, reporter Timothy Egan talks about newcomers across the centuries in the Pacific Northwest. That and more next time on Fresh Air.